Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. We're continuing on in our march through NDP leadership candidates. I'm really looking forward to the conversation that we're going to present tonight. We're recording this, for the record, on March 19th, 2024. It'll be up after that, but I like to say the date in case the province bursts into flames in the next few days. And we don't talk about it for some reason. Everybody's like, oh, how come you didn't ask him about the province blowing up? So all of that out of the way, I am so excited and very grateful for the opportunity to be able to welcome to the show leadership candidate for the NDP, MLA for Edmonton Rutherford, a bunch of other things we're going to get into too. Jody Callahoo Stonehouse. Jody, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yay. Thanks for having me, Nate. I'm thrilled to be here, and let's get to the hard questions.
Well, you know, I got one I want to start with out of the gates.
All right.
Because we've seen throughout the announcement of the various, as I say this, I just realized I think there may be one candidate as of the date of this recording who hasn't released a video, but everybody else has. And everybody else's videos have had various different tones and various different things that they hit on. I don't think anyone was quite as bold as you were in yours. And the statement that you made directly to Premier Daniel Smith, where you were like, pack your bags. That was fantastic. I'm curious, walk me through that. Like, that's a multifaceted statement to make for a lot of different reasons, but what brought you to like, no, you know what? I'm coming out swinging.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what it is, Nate? It's sitting in the legislature, being excited to be a part of democracy, thinking we're going to tackle the complex problems and have these innovative solutions, make life for Albertans better. And then we put in Bill 8, the government, and this allows unlimited gifts for MLAs like myself and remove the cap off of what we can pay, the government can pay folks that they bring in. And I was like, what the? Seriously, we're having a water catastrophe, drought like we've never seen before. We have drier soil than we've ever had in 105 years of Alberta's history. We've had forest fires, like, you know, our education system, our healthcare system, and I'm getting unlimited gifts. This is what you're putting through for government business? Get the fuck out of here. Yeah, that's where it comes from.
That's fantastic. Love the fire. You know, I got another thing that I want to hit on in that section there, because there's pieces of that bill in particular that with the introduction of it, let's say, that I found fascinating little things to touch on. But before we do, because I have a feeling that if I get into the getting on this, we're just going to go and it's going to be wonderful. But I want to make sure that I hit on the things. So before we do, I'm going to ask you to do the same thing that I've asked everybody else, and I ask every guest who comes on the show. For our audience, whether they're listening to the audio version or watching on the internet machine, who is Jody Callahoo Stonehouse?
Well, I would like to say that I'm a humble person. I've been taught many things by pretty extraordinary people in my life. A lot of elders have blessed me with knowledge and insights. I got to spend a tremendous amount of time on the land as a little girl with my grandfather on the trap line. And that's really where my love of the land developed, is we would go walking down the Sturgeon River, where we would have beaver traps and we'd have fishing nets. But he would talk about the relationship between the owls and the mice and the hawks. And, you know, I was learning, you know, ecosystems and biodiversity as a six-year-old, and the importance of these relationships and what happens when you knock one system out of balance, how it disrupts the entire ecosystem. And, you know, I would say I learned a lot picking medicines. My grandfather would take me to where his grandma would take him as a little boy. And, you know, my grandfather lived to be almost 100 years old. So he would tell me stories about his grandparents. And I was lucky enough to get his kitchen table, where he used to tell me Louis Riel came here to ask us to join the rebellion, but we said no because we thought he was crazy. So I come from this rich, deep history. My mother was, a Mohawk woman who was gardening, and we didn't waste anything, recycle, never contaminate, like really strict, lots of love. My stepdad was extraordinary. He was the fire chief in our volunteer firefighting. My grandparents owned the hardware store in a small town. So I had this amazing, childhood where I was running a till in a hardware store in a small town, working at the insurance firm where my mom was in the small town. And then I was out on the land trapping and harvesting, picking berries and medicines. And then, of course, went on to multiple degrees in universities. And my love of the land is what brought me here. And, we're seeing a lot of contamination, a lot of forest fires, the drought. And we're going to need some strategies and some problem solving really quick to make sure that, our ecosystems, such as agriculture, our economic systems, that so they continue to thrive and survive. We're going to be facing some really challenging times as Albertans. And now more than ever, we need to be brave and innovative. So that's a little bit about me. Done a lot of things, raised some kids. I'm grateful for my life, grateful for the teachers who've blessed me. None of my knowledge is my own. It's just all these things and gifts that people have shared with me and presented with me over the years. I don't bring anything special to the game. I just bring what I've been lucky enough to learn from the wise old people.
I gotta say, I love the enthusiasm with which you're talking about your family, you're talking about your history, you're talking about the trap line and all of that kind of stuff. And then you just kind of pepper in there, and there's a couple degrees. But really, let's talk about the other stuff. Like that's I have to ask, because if I didn't, I'd get in trouble. I think that's just so cool what you just did there. But what are the degrees in?
So I went to MRU first, and so I studied specifically, I looked at genetics and I looked at FASD and THC, cocaine, marijuana on the brain. So I studied children with developmental disabilities in community rehabilitation. And so then from there, I went into a BA of Native Studies. And then from there, I went to a Master's of Science in Resource Economics. And then I went to study Indigenous legal theory under John Burroughs and Dr. Val Napoleon at the University of Victoria. Came back and built the Indigenous Legal Lodge at the University of Alberta. So, because Canada is a multi-juridical state, we have legal pluralism, we have common law, civil law, and Indigenous law. So, how can we talk about jurisdiction and authority? Looking at law through multiple lenses. And so that's a little bit of the work. And my research with the Masters of Science was downstream from the oil sands. I was privileged enough to spend time with grandmothers, mothers, daughters, and granddaughters, and listen to the oral tradition about the women's experiences with populations, with species, habitats, migration patterns, and the water.
Like I'm listening to you explain, like go through all of this, and there's a little part of me, I'm just going to be honest, that's like, oh man, do we have to talk about the NDP leadership race? But like, is this,
Well,
you just covered so much ground right there.
oh, and it's such an exciting time, this leadership race. I'm just so thankful to stand along so many incredibly brilliant leaders who believe in change, who are standing up to make Alberta the best possible place. And I'm just really humbled and honored to stand with such extraordinary folks. And ready to debate with them.
Oh man, I'm feeling sorry for them right now, because you're bringing the heat. It's fantastic. So let's get into, I want to get through my list so that I can, because I have so many other questions that I want to ask you. But let's get through the list. To start with, the first question that I've been asking everybody is, I don't think that there's any reasonable question that up until this point in time, the NDP has very much been the party of Rachel Notley. It's been the, and it's important to highlight as well that when we're talking about it being the party of Rachel Notley, I should probably hedge that a little bit and say it's been the party of a Notley for literally decades now. There's a dynasty that has existed inside of the NDP for not a small amount of time. And that dynasty is now coming to an end. And a lot of people are wondering, what does this mean for the NDP? What is the direction that the NDP takes? The way that I phrased it previously, some people are saying, oh, the NDP is going to make a hard run for the hard left. And a lot of other people are saying, no, they're gonna run for the center because that's where they can pick up the most votes. So the question that I'd like to ask you is, under your leadership, what would the NDP future look like?
So I would say we are exactly where we are supposed to be insofar as Rachel built this incredible foundation. Not only Rachel, but also her husband, her entire family. They have committed their life's work to building what we are as a party now. And the incredible folks that we've brought along for MLAs from Calgary, from Edmonton, like the team is impeccable, remarkable, like just outstanding thinkers, leaders, thought leaders. And so when I think about what we're going to be as a government, we're really just going to be very simple, very logical, very reasonable, cleaning up the damn mess kind of politicians. Nothing fancy. It really is about rolling up our sleeves and looking at the systems of healthcare, child and family services. Looking at, the first responders, all of the work that we're going to have to do around reparations of these systems, but also reimagining with folks who work there, folks who use the systems. How do we make it better? Because right now they're falling apart at the seams, they're bursting at the seams. So we're not going to be anything fancy. We have a solid foundation to stand on, and that's thanks to Rachel and her family's sacrifice and their hard work. And so, in honoring that work and that commitment to Albertans, to the NDP party, is to build on it, to strengthen it, and just get our sleeves up and get to work, get cleaning up the mess.
Okay, speaking of cleaning up the mess, I'm going to use that line as my pivot point to the questions on economy and energy. So there has been a, let's go with tension at times between the NDP and where some people believe Alberta's economy and particularly Alberta's energy economy is supposed to or going to go. Where do you see the relationship between an NDP government and under your leadership and the oil and gas sector for the next 20, 30 years?
That's a really important question because that's the foundation of who we are as Albertans. If we think about all of the beautiful things that we do have, it's been thanks to our relatives who've been working, in the oil patch or somewhere in Calgary in a tower connected to the oil and gas industry. So, energy, we are energy leaders, and we have got to stay competitive at the international level with energy. And so if oil and gas are transforming, then we need to be the leaders in that transformation. We need to be the leaders in how we capture carbon. We need to be the leaders in how we're going to transform drilling because we're experts into drilling, into geothermal drilling and generate power through geothermal. We look at examples like Norway. They get 72% of their total power from geothermal. So, there are things that we can do that we are already experts in that are not going to take a huge amount of investment to transform our energy system. We need to continue to make energy, to sell energy so that we are globally competitive. With that competition, with trade and all of those economic systems that we need to navigate, we also have to make sure that families have jobs, that they are being paid equitably for their work, their time away from their families. Everybody wants to make sure that they have a roof over their head, food in their fridge, and heat in their house. And that's our job as government, is to make sure that we are facilitating the transformation from one energy system to another, to support and invest in our talent, to invest in our unions and our all of the industries, so that the work is easier to transfer over, then there's less resistance. There's resistance because there's fear. People want to know they're going to have a job. They want to know that they're going to be able to take their family on holiday or do the things that we have been doing. But none of us are going to be able to do the things we've been doing if the forest fires get out of control, if the drought is unmanageable. So What we have to do first and foremost is deal with the crisis and the emergencies and the chaos and get those under control. And then we can start to invest in post-secondary institutions, get students start to imagine a new energy system. I mean, Alberta, what have we done for the past 4 decades with our royalties? Where has the money gone? Why do we not have education schools of excellence? Why do we not have hospitals that are outstanding in all of Canada? We had more money than any other province in this country. What have we done for ourselves? So, yeah, oil and gas, energy. Energy is the foundation of who we are. And we have to stay in the game. And that moratorium on renewables was absolutely crushing. We lost millions and millions of dollars. We lost investors. And it is going to take us anywhere from 12 to 18 more months to continue that recovery journey, to repair the relationships with investors, to encourage them to come back. And, the folks who had those jobs all of a sudden didn't. I mean, we have work to do. We have a lot of work to do.
I mean, you teed me up right there for the renewables question. I mean, we've seen that in this province, the current government unquestionably has a bias toward what end of the energy sector they want to see grow and what end they'd like to not see grow, maybe so much. Danielle Smith put forward her renewables moratorium, and then she, in effect, in many ways, codified it with the restriction zones. Would you keep the restriction zones? Would you eliminate the
No, that's ridiculous. They're ridiculous. They're embarrassing. It's shameful. And if we were to think about our oil and gas in the same mannerism, like we've just grown accustomed to pump jacks. We don't look at them and go, oh, is that hurting the farmer's agriculture because they're going to have to drive the combine around the pump jack? No, we just accommodate and we drive around it. And we will do the same with wind turbines and solar farms. We have to adapt, and that's part of the gift that we have as Albertans is that over time we have adapted, and we need to continue to do that. That moratorium is just we are going to have to do the work, and we need to be leveraging our experts. We have so many good, qualified people doing stuff. I mean, folks who were doing innovative stuff here have left to go to Germany because they couldn't get investment to do their work here. So this is the kind of thing if, I was so disappointed when so many of the UCP members went to Germany and I thought, oh, good, they're going to see that there they have solar panels on every single house in Germany, pretty much, that they've got wind turbines in Switzerland and Germany. In Norway, they're doing geothermal, they're doing hydro. Like they're going to see this diverse energy system in the way that other countries are thriving. And that wasn't the case, unfortunately. And then they took 140 people to Dubai, which is a complete and total utter waste of money. And we just see these decisions compounding waste after waste after waste. And you think about education, the teachers, you think about the firefighters, you think of, there's so many places we could be investing in Albertans rather than these poor, frivolous decisions that are just causing great harm and chaos in our province.
Does your pro energy and resources policy extend to things like, oh, I don't know, I'm just spitballing here, coal mines on the grassy mountain, perhaps?
Oh, coal mining. I thought Rachel dealt with this. Did she not deal with this?
Evidently not.
Here's the thing, and this is the same with this is the big picture AER stuff. When we look at coal mines, when we look at oil and gas, when we look at any sort of energy development, what is the potential harm it is going to cause to our watersheds, first and foremost, because we know that we are headed into a crisis. Back in the 80s, sure, we had unlimited waters, water everywhere, clean drinking water everywhere, and not to mention Stanley Cups. So they were coming out. I mean, we were doing great in the 80s. It's not the same anymore. We've had record profits leaving our province, but we also have record contamination. And so when we look at companies from Australia coming in to mine the headwaters, you know, what is the AER doing? What is their job? Are they doing their job? Are they invested in? Do they have the water scientists? Do they have the experts who can actually qualify and quantify a reasonable response to ensure that generations of Albertans have a water source that is protected, first and foremost? Because without water, we have nothing.
I mean, the 80s were hard on a lot of organizations. They clearly took their toll on the AAR. Lord knows that they took their toll on at least I can think of one hockey player. There's we paid prices for the 80s. I'd like to talk next about you move very quickly. I'd like to talk next about the questions in regards to, and this gets complicated. I want to acknowledge that right out of the gates. And this was particularly underscored in a really unfortunate way by the Edmonton Police Service last night with their PR video, I guess we would have to call it if we were being generous. There are really big conversations going on in the province right now about the housing crisis with the cost of housing, and that leads into for a growing number of Albertans a homelessness and houselessness crisis. It is. I wish that we could talk about those two things without talking about the demonization and the stigmatization of people who are experiencing housing and houselessness and homelessness. But again, with the video that EPS released yesterday, they doubled down on a trope that has been denied by the victim of the actual crime, and they forgot to edit out the closed captioning. They edited out the video segment, but they left the closed captioning segment in, which is not why are our police in this province having such a hard time with tech these days? That's probably a separate conversation. But what do you make of the let's do it one at a time. So what do you make of the cost of housing crisis? How would you like to see that addressed?
Okay, so you're right. This is a complicated. So we're gonna address this in multiple ways. One, we have to build affordable housing for Albertans. End of story. We have to build it across the province. We need to make sure. I mean, we're inviting foreign workers continuously to come work. We need to make sure they can have a place to live rather than in a tent downtown. That's important. And, you know, part of our history of Alberta is we had more Indian residential schools than anywhere else in the country. Having more Indian residential schools means we have more survivors. With more survivors, that means we have more intergenerational trauma, which means, again, we have the highest numbers of kids in foster care. We had the highest 60 scoop numbers, the millennial scoop. So these are all system kids, system people, if you will, because of the legacy of the Indian residential schools. And so when we think about the housing crisis, the opioid addictions, this is where we need to come together with the federal government, the provincial government, the municipalities, and also the Indigenous governments. And we need to sit together. And this has to be a collective agreement, a shared agreement, where we are building housing with wraparound services, both in the rural spaces and in the urban spaces. Because what we are seeing with folks with complex needs is that we have trauma on the brain, and there are tons of doctors who've done a ton of research. Oh gosh, you know, Dr. Gabor Maté, Dr. Bruce Perry on child development and trauma on the brain. And so we have to create services for where people are at. We know that they have childhood development trauma on their brain, but they're also conflated with potentially maybe crystal meth or other opioid addictions or alcohol. So now we've got multiple injuries on the brain developed, which means functioning and reasoning is going to be very different than the typical person. So that means we have to create housing with wraparound services to support people. And if we look at the economics of it, if we look at what it costs for 800 amputations last winter, what is the math on that? What is the math on the calls for service to firefighters, to police? What is the math on people waiting in hospital services versus then if I needed to go to emergency for a sick kid or whatever, I can't get in there because it's backlogged. So if we just look at the economics of housing people, there's tons of studies that have been done on this that it's actually going to save the taxpayers money over time. And it is the right thing to do. It is the humane thing to do. These folks have had a hell of a life. Many of them don't even know where their moms and dads were from. Like they were taken away from their families at ages 3 to 6 years old. Some of them were driven 500 kilometers on a train to come here, to go to a residential school here. And then at 18, they get let out. And, we know all sorts of compounded, conflated issues. But here's the thing, the root cause is the trauma. And we have to deal with that in order to move forward. In Alberta, this is just the reality. We had more schools than anywhere else in the country, which means we're going to have more work to do, which is why we have to do the partnerships. And we have got to change the trajectory of where we are going because we have more kids in care than ever before. We have more kids dying than ever before. And we have 5 adults a day dying in Alberta. That is insane. 5 human beings a day in Alberta. What are we doing? Something is not working. Spin it around, figure it out, because this is not acceptable to just sit back and let people die.
When you say wraparound services, I have no doubts that right now, if you were to say to, I don't know, let's go with the Premier of Alberta, we need wraparound services in housing communities, she would say, that's exactly what we're building. I'm curious for your take on the current provincial approach, sorry, of abstinence-only based treatment. I could see you're laughing already, so I'm just going to let you go. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think with what I've learned with my own kids who I've been blessed to adopt out of foster care as they aged out and, got them off of some pretty awful addictions and worked with them and supported them, is that every single person I've supported on their journey through recovery has their own journey through recovery. There is no one prescriptive way to support someone in recovery. And to be honest, I've spent a tremendous amount of time downtown in Boyle Street volunteering for many, many years. And, there's one woman, especially I'll never forget. I was maybe 25 at the time when I was spending time with her. And I just asked her, I said, why are you cranked by noon? Like, why are you? Because she was just this beautiful speaker. And she was, I just didn't get it. I was like, why? What's the deal? And then, she tells me that her house burned down with her 5 children in it, and she was the only survivor. And I thought, well, what right do I have to judge? If that were me, I probably would be annihilated as well. So, I think we have to think about people's liberty and choices. And when I think about the ways in which we offer services for recovery, it has to be culturally safe, Indigenous-led. It has to make sense to people's identity. It has to make sense where we feel like we belong somewhere. And this the trouble and the part for me that's really upsetting with where the province is going is, these treatment centers have been contracted out to many Christian organizations. And the Christian faith is a beautiful faith, just the same as Muslim and First Nations. However, we have a tremendous amount of trauma because of the legacy of the Indian residential schools around Christianity. And symbols like the cross or nuns and priests or the Bible, those signifiers of Christianity are often triggers of people's trauma. And so, we're building these centers where you do not get to leave. They're locked in these compassion treatment centers. There's not a lot of compassion when you don't have the liberty to come and go as you choose to. And, what I know about addictions is the better your life is, the less likely you are to use. The more you belong somewhere and have a purpose and are loved, the less likely you are to use. So if we think about the root causes of why people are using, that's where we have to address. Like, what is the purpose for people's lives? What can they do with no education? If we look at the kids in foster care who are coming out, they don't have a Christian value system. They don't have a First Nation value system. They don't have a Muslim value system or any other faith-based value system because they have gone to over between 5 to 50 foster homes in their lifetime. And then in those homes, they may have been or may not have been sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused. But what we do know for sure is they were neglected and they were not loved. So now we literally have thousands of young people angry, don't know where they belong, they have no value systems, and we're going to lock them up and tell them to sober up. I think there are better ways to do this work.
You brought up the 5 deaths a day, and I don't think that any first responder or any ER physician or nurse or anybody who has any exposure to the people who are in the throes of addiction, particularly when it comes to people who are dealing with addictions associated with opioids. One of the biggest causes of death is now not so much the opioids themselves, but the toxicity of the supply. This is a highly contentious and highly emotional issue. Several other candidates have acknowledged as much, but there is no question when we're seeing people buying what they believe to be our opiates being cut with diabetic medications and being cut with other toxic compounds. Well, diabetic medications are not toxic compounds, to be clear, but cut with toxic compounds is how I should have phrased that. When we're seeing that go on, there is a conversation that's going on around safe supply. So, given that any policies that the NDP would ultimately bring forward would be a result of the policy conventions that y'all have, what is your personal stance on safe supply? Would you advocate for a safe supply policy at one of these NDP policy conventions, or would you advocate against one?
So I wish I had a yes or no black white response to that. What I do know is really important is that we have to have harm reduction, community-based, Indigenous-led programming and services. And so I think it's going to be really important that we watch the data coming out of BC, coming out of Alberta, because we want to make the best informed choices. We also want to look at what's happening in San Francisco and other places in the world and look at other models, the Portuguese model, right? And figure out what is working in some places and how might we adapt and modify that to work here in Alberta. I'm not sure that there's a one right answer. I think we are going to have to try multiple strategies because it is just so crippling and terrifying the reality that folks are facing. And not only the lived realities that people are immersed in with their addictions, I also think about the first responders. You know, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, bringing people back to life over and over, I can't even imagine, but I'm sure it has impact on people's well-being. And, this isn't something they had to manage 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And so we also have to invest in our first responders. We haven't done that very well. We haven't invested in how we respond to this kind of trauma. This level of addictions, what is the healthcare system going to look like specifically around opioids and addiction? And we're going to have to invest money in research and collect data. And then we make the decisions together. It's not just a one vision, one right answer. I think there's going to be multiple strategies that we're going to have to use.
I'll rephrase the question then.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree with you, to be clear. I when I ask the question around safe supply, I'm not saying, and that's the only thing we do, because obviously that wouldn't yield any sort of, I mean, probably less deaths, but in regards to, helping people extricate themselves from addiction, probably not so much. But, there is a there are people who are making the argument that if you take a look at the death rates in BC, they are not seeing the same sort of massive growth that we're seeing here in Alberta. And BC has introduced, in measure, something of a safe supply program. There's certainly many people who would argue that the IOET program that exists already in Alberta is a form of safe supply. So the way that I'll rephrase the question then is, if there was compelling, reliable evidence that was presented to you that said, hey, we can save, of those five people a day, we can save one and a half. Would that be a policy that you would advocate for? Would that be a policy that you would say, I'm going to leave it to the membership because, yow, a hot potato? Or would you advocate against it?
No, I think we would have to look at it in conjunction with how are we improving people's quality of life. So not only saving people's lives, but their lives have to be improving. That's the whole point, right? Nobody, people use because they're numbing their pain. They use because their life is not a great place, wonderful place to be. So whether it's safe supply or unsafe supply, addictions are addictions because people's lives hurt, because their reality sucks. So our job is to fix the problem, which is how do we improve people's quality of life? And if it means, and the data shows, having safe supply, then that has to be part of the response. But I don't believe wholeheartedly that solely that's going to fix anything. I think it's going to be a combination of responses.
Yeah, no, I no question that it if there was anybody who is advocating only for free drugs always, I would have a lot of questions for those people as well. I want to talk about the houselessness piece a little bit more, because I think one of the conversations that is worth having is, we, you're aspiring to be the leader of the highest office in the land. How would you lead the conversation around houselessness and the stigmatization that exists towards people who are experiencing houselessness? How would you lead that conversation? How would you change that conversation? Would you keep it the same? What would be your approach to that?
The approach would be we were just going to create some legislation and invest in affordable housing. We're just going to do it. End of story. There's no reason not to. It's embarrassing. And I shake my head. It's 2024. We had a $5 billion surplus. No one wants to talk about that. Yeah, we're just continuously lighting money on fire. And this is about stopping the hemorrhaging. And so reducing the costs over time means that we are going to put people in houses. Nothing fancy. Affordable housing is not fancy, but it's housing nonetheless. And it's the humane thing to do.
I think it's important, and this is an issue that I know some people feel has been talked about to death. Unfortunately, the reality is as long as this issue is talked about, there will be deaths that come of it. And I'm going to talk now and ask for your thoughts on the healthcare policy suite that Danielle Smith announced in regards to gender-affirming care for kids. Gender-affirming care for adults, choice in sports for adults, which I still find like, what? Why are we? But I've asked every.
Okay, Nate, I'm going to just tell you straight up what I think about all this. So, my great grandfather was a treaty signatory. Okay, Michelle, when he sat with that treaty pipe, it's a sacred covenant because let me tell you, I asked the elders repeatedly, why don't we burn these treaties? And they were like, that's not our way, my girl. We're built on respect and love and kindness. And that treaty is as long as the sun shines, the grass grows, and the rivers flow, we will live as relatives on these lands. We didn't say, if you're queer, you can't come here. If you're Muslim, you can't come here. If you're Christian, you can't come here. That treaty is for all people. And that is the foundation of our belief system, that there's room for everyone in this circle. And so when I think about these policies that, again, have been spent millions of dollars on, While the province is burning down and there's going to be no water and no plan for the cattle to be moved, for the irrigation systems to be picked up, for the towns to get water shipped. We're already shipping water at $10,000 a day. That's a distraction. Deal with the issues of your mismanagement and your incompetency. Targeting trans kids, which is what, 0.023% of the population? Get over it. Like, you're wasting my time and my money. And Albertans, we have a place to go, and that is to the future. We have to figure out how we are going to survive the next decade and let our children have the decade after that, which means getting smart about the future. And we cannot be stuck in 1982. And that's what that did, is it brought us back in time. And it's horrible. It's divisive. It's harmful. And, I mean, these are the kids who have the highest rate of suicide. What are you doing? What are you doing? It's insanity, and it's hurtful. And that's not how politics should be done in my homelands. They're done with love and grace and kindness, because there is space for everyone here. And my grandfather sacrificed when they signed that treaty. That was the agreement. We would live as relatives. That's not what you do to relatives.
So you'd repeal the policies then.
Absolutely. And here's the thing, the Alberta Medical Association right away came out and said, actually, we don't do any of this. Again, wasting time and money.
I got a couple more things that I want to ask you about. And as we're working our way towards some of the bigger ideas that I want to ask you about, I'm actually making myself uncomfortable, and I'll address that in a bit. But before we get there, there's been in the announcement, and unfortunately, I haven't had the opportunity to ask every candidate about this because time is linear. But there's been a national announcement in regards to the PharmaCare program. And as soon as the PharmaCare program was announced, details be damned, the UCP came out and said, oh, we don't want nothing to do with that. We don't want to have free diabetes medications or birth control because it's not free. I still don't understand the logic. I have listened to her speak so many times, it hurts, and I just can't wrap my head around, wait, so because it's not everything everywhere all at once, we're going to say no to the free stuff now. It's very confusing. What are your thoughts on the PharmaCare, National PharmaCare program, and would you bring Alberta in were you to become the Premier of Alberta?
Yes, yes, and yes. I think anytime that we can partner and lift the financial burden off Albertans, that's a smart move. And so, if the federal government has said we are going to invest in healthcare for your citizens, excellent. Let's do the agreement. Let's do the partnership. Because here's the thing that I'm witnessing. As we see the legislators sit in this beautiful dome and our fancy chairs, most, I would say all of the people in there can afford their medication, can afford their birth control, and could help their niece or their grandchild if they needed to. If we look at the majority of Albertans are struggling to pay their utility bill, which has doubled in the past year, right? They don't want to have to take on extra costs and expenses for diabetes medication for their mom or their mother-in-law. I mean, people looking after aging parents, this is a real thing. How can you afford to put your parents in a care facility? Do we even do that anymore in Alberta? Have you been to one lately? Have you seen the services one lately? As I've been touring around and visiting people, I am absolutely mortified, mortified at how we treat the elders, the people who built the foundation of where we live. Their blood, sweat, and tears is in every institution that we have the luxury and the privilege of participating in. And yet we can't afford proper care for a lot of these facilities, inadequate care. I mean, it just completely dumbfounds me. I think it's irresponsible and reckless, and it's time to clean it up.
I hear the carpet in the legislature is very nice too.
It's actually, I just think about the bugs that live in it, but it is kind
Oh.
of fluffy.
Had an MLA once tell me that one of his favorite things to do was to take his shoes off. and just scrunched the carpet with his toes. And he was like, if you ever get the opportunity, I was like, I don't think that's gonna happen. But he said that the carpet was truly remarkable.
Okay, who is the strange one, Nate? Out them.
I can't do that. He's far too nice of an individual for me to risk embarrassing in any way. And he's a good dude, so I'm not gonna do that.
You're good. You're nice.
Well, that's open to interpretation. Because here's the thing. There are some more issues that I want to talk to you about. And as we've been winding our way through this conversation, I have had my own little sort of like, moment with myself because, and I'm just gonna say the thing and then we can hopefully get into the issues if you're not too mad at me. But one of the things that I've been really looking forward to since we set up this conversation is I was really looking forward to having some conversations with you about truth and reconciliation, about the complexities that exist, in the various different, I didn't even know about your background with all the governance stuff. That's why I was like, oh, do we still have to talk about the NDP leadership race? But there's a lot of nuance to the governance structures that exist between the provincial government, the federal government, municipal governments, and First Nations governance structures. I'm going to phrase things carefully. Here's the thing that I want to apologize for in advance. I'm just realizing now, and part of it was probably due to some time limitations that I had imposed with some of the other candidates, but I'm just realizing now that I did not ask any of the other candidates for their positions on truth and reconciliation or relations with First Nations. And so before I ask you any questions on any of those things, I just want to own that out of the get-go, and apologize because I should have. And so there's my little like, oh, damn it. Moment that I had about 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, and it's an important moment. And I hope those of you watching and listening, this is the work that we have to do. And this is why it's so important that I'm part of the conversation, because
Yes.
we are here, we exist, we're political, we're intelligent, we're capable, we're competent, and we care. You know, as many times as I said, why can't we burn these treaties? They haven't kept their promises. Why should we keep ours? The elders, time and time and time again, you know, talked about, you know, we lifted our pipe. That's our most sacred object. We made a covenant between Creator, Gitche Manitou, between God and the commissioners, that we would live together and look after one another and look after the water and the land as relatives. And so, you know, I'm thankful that those elders instilled that in me, because it helped to subside the rage, because there is a lot to be angry about. But what I've learned is that rage and anger doesn't solve problems. And I see it in the legislature. I see the frustration in our own party, and we're not able to fix the problems, which is why in 2027, we're going to be the government, and it's not going to be fancy. We're just going to clean up the mess and help move us in a positive, strong direction for what the next decade outlines for us. And it's going to be work for all of us. All of us are going to be adapting and doing things a little differently. You know, one of the first things, Nate, that you know, really surprised me, coming from Indigenous governance, and I've been privileged to be in the big house, in the long house, in the Sundance lodges, and you know, and all of the governance, there's ceremony and feasting and, you know, this deliberation and building consensus. So it sometimes can take, when we're doing the Great Law of Peace, it takes like 10 days and 10 nights to get through the process itself of governance. And so, you know, and then you come into this legislature space, and I remember being so condescending about heckling, and I was like, wow, who does that? That's so childish. Give me all of 5 minutes and gloves are off. And I'm like, let's go. I'm just the biggest heckler in there now. It's terrible. My mother would wash my mouth out with soap, I'm sure of it. But it's, you know, and maybe that's the gift that I get to bring with me, is that consensus building, you know, this notion of a decentralized authority rather than this hierarchical authority that we're so used to in the Western lens, where The water and the land have just as much agency and authority as human beings do. That's the Cree worldview. That's the perspective that I get to bring with me, is that we have to take care of the water and the land because it takes care of us. And when we neglect them, we're neglecting ourselves. And we're going to see the result of some of those choices. And so we have work to do. I mean, we've had record contamination down in the Delta and the Athabasca. I mean, there's no reason for it. With record profits, with the innovation and the research, there's no reason for it. So clean it up.
I love how you just end on these like little one-liners. It's fantastic. I do have some questions that I want to ask about that, if that's okay. Sort of the complexity that exists between those governance structures, because as you highlighted there, the traditional, and I'm choosing my words so carefully, and I'm going to screw it up anyways. I know it, but the traditional governance structures that exist and were handed down within First Nations, which are different between different nations. And that's a really important thing that I think that we don't talk about enough. Those s exist at the same time as the governance structures that were imposed by the Indian Act. And I would love to get your take on how do we, I'm gonna, sorry, Mom, I'm gonna use a word. How do we unfuck that? Because there is, for somebody, I speculate, for somebody in a role like yours, you're taking part in the colonial,
Colonial.
yeah, governance structures, while still you're participating in the traditional governance structures. And how does somebody who is premier, other than getting awarded the occasional heritage, headdress or ribbon skirt, how does somebody as premier help bring along everybody who doesn't understand all of Alberta? Literally, all of Alberta is treaty land. And so all Albertans are treaty people. And it's probably a good idea to understand how incredibly complex this all is. How would you approach that as premier?
Well, and not only is it complex, it's also very simple and very beautiful in the fact that in Alberta, we have three treaty areas, 6, 7, and 8, which means we are all treaty people. And so, in being treaty people, that means there are treaty responsibilities and obligations to each other, to the land, and to the water. And so, in understanding the rule of law, and our constitution, like treaty is the foundation. It is what all of these systems of law are built on. And so it's an opportunity to remind us of our rich, beautiful history so that we know who we are as a province, as a people, because the elders have always said you have to know who you are in order to know where you're going. And so in order for us to really be able to go where we need to go in the future and to go there together, we're going to have to take this journey, which means we have to learn about one another. We're going to have to, have face-to-face conversations. Some non-Indigenous folks might actually have to go to an Indian reservation, go to a powwow, go to a celebration, right? We have to build relationships, and that's the peace and treaty. It's based on peace and friendship. We have these treaties. And we don't even know each other anymore. Literally, cities of strangers everywhere. And that's also part of the problem. And so, how do we get to know each other so that way we're obligated to each other as well? Because it's far too easy for us to turn a blind eye and watch someone suffer. And we're not going to be able to do that because the forest fires, people are going to need to relocate, they're going to need help moving. With the water drought, we're going to need to be innovative and support our ranchers and our farmers. We need, and this is what Alberta, when I was a kid, this is what we did. This is how we did it. And this is part of who we are as Albertans. Through COVID, I really thought more of our identity and our need to connect with each other and support each other would, just naturally, organically blossom. But in fact, that's, we're seeing the opposite. And so we have to do the work to meet people where they're at, regardless if I agree with their politics or their policy. They're still Albertans. We're all Albertans, and we have to figure this out together. And so I think it's a strength bringing treaty into it, bringing in that we must look after one another as relatives. As long as the sun shines, the grass grows, and the rivers flow, there is no exit clause out of this agreement. We cannot get out of this. And you know, the goal is that I'm able to bring the strengths of the hereditary system. I mean, if we think about gift actualization, and so often what helped happened with the hereditary system, like when I was a little girl, when I would get ready to sit for the trap line in the morning at 4 a.m., we're having our, you know, oatmeal and coffee. My grandfather would say, "How's my lawyer this morning?" Right? Like he was already preparing me as a little girl on where he saw my gifts. I guess I was a bit of a talker. And then, you know, we see that with our fire keepers, the teenagers who are gifted to stay up all night. They organically have this gift. They're going to be the fire keepers. And then our singers and our song carriers, you know, it's recognizing children where their strengths are, nurturing those strengths. So then, you know, often our leaders in the hereditary system, they have been taught their entire life by elders and chiefs, clan mothers, and the hereditary system on how to be a leader, on how to sacrifice. In our worldview, the leader eats last. You make sure your people are fed. The leader sacrifices to make sure the people thrive. That's what it means to be a leader, is that you are the back of the bus eating the last so that your people are healthy and well. And I think that's a strength I bring to our politics because we could use a little humility in that place.
I mean, you teed me up for the uncomfortable questions that I wanted to ask, because I think you're bang on. There is a greater need for humility. I think there's a greater need for representation without having to claim a space in the groups that you're working to represent. We have seen the current premier of this province well, not simultaneously, but alternately claim to be of Métis ancestry. We have seen her claim to be of Cherokee heritage. We have seen that claim largely rebutted by APTN. And in a move that I'm like, I got to be clear. This is my check my privilege moment. I am the middle-aged white guy, and my jaw dropped when, in front of all of the treaty nations, she was like, "Well, let me tell you about my native heritage," and she doubled down on that claim. It seems like that sort of rhetoric is really counterproductive to the higher goals of truth and reconciliation. So I'm curious, what's it like for you as somebody who is Cree, who is Mohawk, to have somebody go, "I'm totally white presenting, and based on no evidence whatsoever, I get what you're all feeling."
It's troublesome, right? It's the erasure of Indigenous women, and you know, she's in a very privileged space. And you know, if she is Cherokee and if she is Métis, then prove it. Otherwise, it's fraud. It's identity fraud. And people go to jail in this country for identity fraud when they are saying that they are someone that they are not. That is not a legal thing that we can do in this country. And so I'm baffled as to why people think it's okay to say they're First Nations or Métis or Inuit and they're not, to privilege themselves in politics, in academia. You know, I mean, we were crushed when Buffy Saint Marie came out because, you know, she was everyone's icon and we all loved her. And that was devastating. And so, you know, for her to present herself in that way is very troublesome. And I would suggest that she get her evidence out sooner rather than later.
Did it on that same vein, one of the other things that when you talk about Bill 8 and the gifts, one of the things that Smith used to justify that.
The ribbon skirt,
I'm so
the
sorry. I'm so sorry I have to ask these
ribbon
questions, but
skirt. Yeah,
help.
she did. She did. And the truth be told is some of these ribbon skirts are beautiful artistry, and some of them are $375, $400. Then pay that indigenous artist out of your pocket because you are making an income that allows you to do that. You don't need to take free ribbon skirts from the poorest people in the province, is what I would say.
Thank you for that. And I
Yeah.
like it is, and I just it is endlessly frustrating for me. And again, totally taking a sec to acknowledge my peak middle-aged white guy privilege in the province of Alberta. It is endlessly frustrating for me to see the performative nature with which people wrap themselves in First Nations and Indigenous and Métis stories and history and regalia when convenient, and then are horrid. I don't like that, and I'm very sorry that people keep doing that. So there's that, I guess.
Yeah, we have work to do, and
You.
that's the beauty of the TRC calls to action. The commissioners work tremendously hard, and so that's government's responsibility to make sure that institutions, whether they're education or healthcare, that we're implementing these calls to action, that we're ensuring that every citizen in this province, whether they're First Nations, Métis, or from anywhere else in the world, that they're getting adequate, proper services and access to what they need to live a comfortable life here in this beautiful province. The prosperity that this province has experienced is astronomical. So we should expect institutions of excellence.
Oh, I know what line's going to be the promo line for this episode.
I just have I have high expectations, and I've been very, very disappointed with what I've witnessed, and that's why I'm running. Wasn't like I thought, ooh, one day I want to be the premier of Alberta. That wasn't the goal at all. But you just can't sit back when it's this awful and this horrendous and do nothing. I have to do everything that I possibly can to change things for everyone. It's horrible. And it doesn't need to be. This is the craziness of it all. It actually doesn't need to be as chaotic as it is.
I gotta say, I have been intrigued at the idea of the NDP leadership debates. I'm excited now. I think those are going to be, oh, I'm going to be watching you. The fire and the passion that you bring to all of these topics is really, really admirable. And the patience that you showed me, also very much appreciated. I want to give you the floor. So I've gotten through all of the topics that I wanted to try to get to awkwardly at times. What is it that you want people to hear? What is it that you want people to know? Please include your website and all of that good stuff in here as well. The floor is yours for however long you want it.
Thanks, Nate. I want to thank you for inviting me and for the work that you do. It's really important that you're sharing not just mine, but all of my colleagues' perspectives, so that way everyone gets a full picture of who we are during this very exciting time, because we're demonstrating that we're just not competing to be the new Democrat leader. We're competing to be the next premier of Alberta. And so, one of the ways to participate in that choice is to make sure you're buying a membership. And you can do that on all of our websites. Mine is voteforjody.ca, Jody with an I. And you can do that also on the Alberta NDP website. So, you buy a membership. So, this is a little different for folks. The voting system, you buy a membership, they mail you a ballot, and then it's a ranked system. So you put in who is your first choice, second choice, third choice, all the way down to the bottom. So you'll be getting that in the mail, and then you can phone it in or text it in or mail it back to the party. So it's an exciting time, and every vote's going to count, so participate. And I think if there's anything I want people to know about me is that I think fundamentally, in order to fix any of our problems, we must address our economic diversification. That has to be paramount. As we know in our own homes, you know, we accrue debt, whether it's through our mortgages, our car payments, these kinds of things. Debt is okay as long as it's in a reasonable amount and we're making our payments and we're investing in the right things. And we have got to invest in the future. We've got to invest in AI. We've got to invest in renewables. We have to invest in carbon capture. There are many, many things that we have got to start doing differently in Alberta, which means we're going to have to invest in our talent. We have to invest in our tradespeople. We're going to have to retrain some folks. We're going to relearn some things together. This is how we're growing and changing as a province. But it's important that we do the work so we can remain leaders of the energy sector, so we can remain leaders in the global economic market. We have to do the work now. So, you know, I think that's the most important. And then when we have the income and the revenue, we can pay our doctors adequately, pay our nurses, our teachers, our firefighters, right? We can build the buildings, do the infrastructure. All of those things will transform and become institutions of excellence when we are investing our money wisely.
You really like firefighters, hey?
Well, my daughter is training to be a firefighter.
Okay, because I was like, paramedics are cool too.
And my dad's a paramedic, yes.
Okay,
my
there
dad
we go.
was. Yeah. So I grew up with emergency responders, and I don't take for granted the toll it takes on their families, the work. And, you know, as we see more forest fires, that people are going to be traveling away. I mean, we should be investing in training people now. Don't get me started, Nate.
I have a feeling we could probably do like a whole 3-hour conversation. And I'm going to say, I would like to preemptively extend an invitation for after the leadership race, whether you're a premier or a force of nature as a speaker. There's so much more that I would like to talk to you about. And I really do want to reiterate how much I appreciate the patience with me that you've shown tonight. And you know, I'm going to do one more awkward thing. I find one of the challenges, particularly with hosting this show, one of the challenges that exists is it's always very difficult to know who are you allowed to ask certain questions of, and how do you ask those questions? And I have learned more than anything by trial and error and error and error and error. But it's one of those spaces and one of those conversation spaces that's so important when we talk about the truth and reconciliation piece. And you know, there was a part of me that was, as I was approaching this interview, I've been counting down the days, and I was just like, I'm so excited to hear Jody's perspective on all of these things. And it because I was so excited to hear your perspective, I totally forgot to ask everybody else theirs. And should any of them become, I'm going to put out a tweet is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to ask them that for their thoughts on how they would provide leadership and truth and reconciliation, because I should have asked those questions. And I didn't. And I'm just going to say it, and I'm going to get DMs on this. The very last thing that I wanted to do was in any way make you feel as if I was, I'm going to talk to the, I'm going to get in so much trouble.
Well, here's
I'm
the thing.
Talk to the Indian, and I don't want.
Well, I am the first First Nations
person, yes,
and brought in for leadership, right? So Yeah, we have to have these conversations. We're breaking down stereotypes. This is how we work through it. We have to have the uncomfortable conversations. And you ask the important things. How am I bringing my indigeneity, who I am, the hereditary system that's ingrained in my DNA and in my political background? How am I bringing that? My grandfather was chief, my mother was a politician. Like my mother, would bring me to band meetings when I was a kid. I mean, that's fun.
Well, especially if they take as long as you say they do.
Right. So, those things influence who we are. And it's really important now more than ever that we share who we are. And, I mean, if we can bring any amount of kindness and patience to the political realm, to our relationships with each other, I think that matters. I think that matters a lot more than we give it credit for. And, I often think about what was missing in all the research I did in academia and all the publishings that I wrote or that I read and all the work I've done politically across the country. And you know what's the one thing we don't talk about is love. And that is the one thing a human being will die, a child will have what we call failure to thrive if they don't receive love. So, I think about the big picture stuff, the small picture stuff, and not that I'm a hippie doing, the hippie dance. I just think, really, we need more kindness, more love, more tolerance, more patience, because we have to clean this up together. We have to prepare for future generations. We have to get our institutions, we have to fix them. Because they cannot continue the way they are going. They are imploding and it will cause more harm. And that is not good for any of us. So, yeah, let's get our shovels and start digging. And we can swear at each other, but at the end of the day, I need to know if my house was burning down that I could come over and you'd help me. And I think that's important. I think as Albertans, we do that.
Jody, I want to thank you for the ferocity that you've shown, the passion that you've shown. And boy, I'll tell you, if I was any of the other NDP leadership candidates right now, I'd be very, very nervous. You have a stunning, like, again, I go back to the beginning, how you said, well, I did the trap line in this and I got a couple degrees. Like the humility that you have there, you're definitely underplaying your hand. And it's gonna, I'm even more excited than ever to watch this race play out. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat tonight.
Thank you, Nate, and keep up the great work.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. Whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of the Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.